Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 190 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Let me run through the co-host lineup. First, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
190?
Isn't it hard to believe? Coming up on 200.
I don't even feel near that old. Well, welcome to everybody.
Also, co-hosting is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi, folks. Yeah, it's 190. And just to give everyone a heads up, I threw out a posting about our bicentennial episode coming up. So go out to our Facebook page and tell us what you might want to hear us ramble about on episode 200.
Yeah, and there's some great suggestions out there. It's going to be tough to kind of choose between them, but a lot of good material for us to think about. So thanks to our listeners for that. Also, let me introduce Dan Webb. He's from the Things in the Sky blog. Hey, Dan.
Hey. Insert comment about episode 190 and how long it's been here.
You're welcome to the podcast. Openings haven't been as vibrant as in the past.
I'm sorry.
Okay. We have to work on that.
That's my homework.
Okay.
Yeah, but you know why he's not vibrant. He knows he's going to be finished with school soon, and he'll have no place left to hide.
That's right. The real world is out there waiting for Dan Webb.
There's always your house.
Yeah.
Dan, we're coming to get you.
Simba and I can hang out.
Hey, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Our guest this episode is Captain Steve Fulton. He's a technical fellow with GE Aviation, and you may recall him from episode 127. That was when we talked with Steve last. Steve was the pilot at Alaska Airlines who helped develop the world's first R&P procedure. That's required navigation performance. He was a co-founder of Navaris. That's now part of GE. And Steve, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Max. Really happy to be back. I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to come back and be with you and Rob and Dan and David and talk about my favorite subject.
And on that favorite subject, maybe for the benefit of our new listeners, you can give us just a brief description of what R&P is all about.
R&P, as you said, the definition, obviously not something that was coined or defined by marketing people, not the yeah. greatest name in the world, required navigation performance or R&P. But what we're doing is we're connecting the true performance of the airplane with defined paths, or some people call them trajectories. And the objective is to get the airplane off the runway, pointed in the direction of flight as quickly as you can, as short as distance as possible, optimized unrestricted climb to altitude, and then likewise on the arrival from cruise back down to the runway. And so when we're all done in the terminal environments, you'll just have a pre-wired network of arrivals and departures that take into consideration all of the different constraints, airspace issues, and so forth. And then once we have that in place, then we can begin to organize the airspace like we do other modes of transportation. Think about trains on rails and sequence and coordinate on time and have a much more synchronized operation. It's a lot behind that, but that's at a high level what we're talking about.
Sure. All right. It's fascinating stuff. It has big implications on lots of different levels. So we'll be looking forward to talking to you about what's happened in that arena in the last year since we last talked with you. But Before we do that, we'll follow our usual format, start out with some aviation news from the past week. After that, we'll spend some time with Steve. And then David brings us a little bit of history with his This Week in Aviation segment. And, of course, that includes the aircraft of the week. And, David, my short-term memory is not the best, so why don't you remind at least myself, if not everybody, about what aircraft is the one that's on this week?
This week, it's the Torpedo Bomber Douglas, otherwise known as the TBT Devastator, and one very famous pilot who flew it.
All right. After that, we've got the Australia Desk Report. That's from Steve N. Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Then we have Across the Pond. That's Peter Johnson's segment covering European aviation. He's going to be taking a look at aviation in India, actually, this episode. And then we'll finish off with maybe a Grill the Geeks question or two. That's our segment where we ask listeners to submit questions and see if we have what it takes to answer them. And then we'll close out with a little bit of listener mail. First, though, let's get started right away with the aviation news.
Mm-hmm.
first story comes from Flight Global. This is stretched potential for Boeing 777. Well, on March 2nd of this year, the 1,000th Boeing 777 rolled off the assembly line. And if memory serves me correctly, the first 777 that entered service in 1995 must have been United. Does that sound right, guys?
First flight was in 94, introduced into service in 95.
And now here we are in 2012, and Boeing has decided that they might launch a, quote, conceptual 777X family, something that might compete against the Airbus A350. Now, they haven't settled on this yet. Firm configuration would occur in 2015, with an entry into service maybe in 2019. So it's, you know, it's a bit off into the future.
Well, it's interesting just because we've seen now on the narrow body side, we've had both Boeing and Airbus stick with their existing product line and just upgrade from there instead of doing a clean sheet aircraft. And now we were seeing the exact same thing on the 777 side. So it'll be interesting to see. It looks like this is still early days, but I'm very much looking forward to see how exactly this aircraft stacks up against the A350. And if that helps, this will help Boeing. And this probably will help Boeing keep market share in this area.
Yeah, and I mean, Boeing really wants to keep the 777 family line going. Obviously, you know, hugely successful, you know, great aircraft. And, you know, they don't want to see Airbus walk away with the sort of the A350 sized market. So, I mean, there's just so many questions that really aren't answered at this point. But things like, you know, construction composites and, you know, what will they take from the 787 and apply to the to a possible 777X and those kinds of questions.
If Boeing can meet at least what's been reported for to be the improvement in performance, would be pretty significant. According to the article, the 777-9X would have a 21% improvement in fuel burn per seat and a 16% improvement in cash operating cost per seat versus the existing 777-300ER. Hmm. So,
but Max, go ahead, Dan.
Well, the other thing I found, this article has a diagram, and I was just impressed about this aircraft is slated to have a 71-meter wingspan, which is 2.5 meters wider than the 747-8. I feel this is going to be fun for some airports to have gate space ready.
Oh, that's a good point.
Well, how does that compare to an A380, though, Dan?
Hold on.
But in the meantime, Max, I just want you to know that I really have figured it out. Is a bigger 777 means that when they come around to replace KC-10s, Boeing will have a ready product for it. Tanker Wars Part 2.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Hey, Dan, while you're looking that up, this is Steve. One of the things that was interesting to me, if you remember, the original 777 had the folding wing concept. This was so they could use the existing gates for the DC-10 airplanes.
Hmm.
And then they worked the design so that wasn't necessary, so it went by the wayside early on. One of the articles on this airplane, I saw that was still kind of being kicked around, that this wing is getting so long that, again, trying to keep it compatible with the existing infrastructure, this was something that was being floated again. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
And I just looked up, the A380 has a wingspan of almost 80 meters.
And this one last point that I'd mention on the article from Flight Global is they note that the engine for this would be the GE9X, which is I guess a smaller derivative engine of the GE90, as I understand it.
Yeah, but you know what's really cool in one of these things too is to sit about 4 or 5 rows in front of the wing on a window seat, yes, and then look out at the wing and the way it is bent up.
Watch it flex.
Cruise.
Yes.
I mean, it is.
I love that.
It's way over the top of the fuselage.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's cool.
I've had a chance to fly in the 380 a couple times, and sitting on the wing, Rob, one of the things that was a little bit concerning to me, I couldn't see the wingtip while we were taxiing. And then as we started the takeoff roll, it comes into view as the lift transitions to the wing. It's really interesting to watch that wing work.
Watch it appear, the tip appear.
Yeah.
Have you flown anything, Steve, that has that little TV camera behind the gear like the A380 did? I mean, I thought that
only
was pretty
as a passenger.
Cool.
Yeah, only as a passenger.
Yeah, that's pretty cool though. When you just kind of, you know, it's like remote control on TV. It's kind of like UAV flying, I guess, right?
Yeah, they got the camera up in the top of the vertical stabilizer. So you're sitting there in your seat and you're looking out over this whole planform of the airplane. You know, the fuselage and the wings, and as you're going around over the sky and making maneuvers through the clouds for landing, it's really something to watch.
All right, let's push on to the next story. This is from our own Dan Webb. This is from the Things in the Sky blog. Multiple carriers file for new beyond perimeter DCA slots. Dan, what's going on here?
Yes, so the finally passed FAA reauthorization, which I hope to talk to Steve about in a little bit, also included some new beyond perimeter flying for Washington National Airport. And it created a total of, I believe, 8 slot pairs for beyond perimeter operations. Half of those were set for incumbent carriers, half for limited incumbent. So the 4 incumbent carriers that can use these are United, Delta, American, and U.S. Airways. 3 of those have already told the DOT what they're using for. American will be adding a single flight to Los Angeles, and that's a flight that American's been trying to get for over 10 years now, if I recall correctly. And in fact, TWA used to fly that route, but due to some restrictions on how some of these certain beyond perimeter slots can be traded, American couldn't keep those when they bought TWA. Delta's going to add a second daily flight to Salt Lake City. United will be adding a single daily flight to San Francisco. U.S. Airways hasn't made any choice. The other 4 slot pairs are for new entrant, so brand new carriers, or limited incumbent, or very small carriers at the airport. And we saw a bunch of applications, and it was interesting. Air Canada wants to go to Vancouver, Alaska wants to go to Portland and San Diego, Frontier wants to go to Colorado Springs, JetBlue wants to do San Juan and Austin, Southwest wants to go to Austin as well, Sun Country wants to go to Las Vegas, and Virgin America is applying for 2 daily San Francisco. And if you click on the link to my blog in the show notes, I have a little cheat sheet. And recently I had the opportunity to chat with Virgin America's CEO David Cush about their desires to serve Washington National. And I was asking him about their application, and I was thinking that some of the other airlines competing with Virgin for these slots might say that, well, United's already adding service from National to San Francisco, so why should another carrier be allocated slots for San Francisco, and shouldn't the DOT focus on other markets? And here's what he had to say.
My first response would be, as far as San Francisco, is that San Francisco is the second largest beyond perimeter market from Washington to Los Angeles. You know, Los Angeles is first. Much larger than Denver and Phoenix and other places that already have multiple frequencies. So if you look at the way the doctrine was written in the past, it basically favored western hubs, the kind of mountain west hubs, very simply because it focused much more on network utility than O&D utility. That's been changed with this order. This order says that O&D utility is as important as network utility. So that really favors going, in all honesty, it really favors putting all of the frequencies into San Francisco and Los Angeles. That even if you did that, it would still be an underserved market as compared to Phoenix and Denver and other destinations.
So yeah, I found that interesting. Applications for the limited incumbent and new entrant carriers were due this past Monday. And I believe the 27th is a due date for the carriers to submit comments on each other's applications. And I just love the DOT docket as an airline dork because obviously it's completely public. You can go on regulations.gov and follow it. But it's just the only place where you will find airlines openly slamming each other. And it's I just
on the
find
record,
it,
huh?
It, well, it, yeah, I mean, these are public government documents, and if these carriers, a lot of times it's fighting over, you know, we've seen things fighting over slots like at National or LaGuardia, or you know, one of the more recent ones was when there was a limited number of slots at Tokyo Haneda Airport, and there's a big fight over that. So I guess, as I like to tell friends, the DOT docket is my replacement for keeping up with the Kardashians. So it'll be interesting to see how this all pans out.
Okay. Very good. Thanks, Dan. All right. Ready for the next item? We can move on to the Seattle PI. Boeing finishes tests for GE engine 787. Now, you might recall that if you buy a 787, you can select engines from Rolls-Royce or GE. Rolls-Royce offers the Trent 1000, and GE offers the GE-NX. What's been certified and delivered so far is just the Rolls engine. And the article notes that Boeing has finished the flight tests for certification of the GE-NX on the 787. So all of the 787s delivered so far, which have been to ANA, have been Rolls-powered. And I think, Japan Airlines gets the first GE-powered aircraft?
Yeah, so the launch customer was the Rolls airplane. And as you said, we're really excited to see this next phase of the 787.
Yeah, this is great. And I think this is not entirely unusual for different engine options for a single aircraft to be certified at different points in time. I think they're not usually done concurrently.
Right. Yeah, the launch customer usually is the one that takes the lead, and that's the case here.
So that's great news that, you know, that's progressing. I don't know if that's on target or not, on the timeline, but at least that's a major milestone, so that's very good.
Is there anything in the 787 timeline that's on target?
I don't know. Maybe not. But yeah, it certainly is quite a delayed airplane, as David mentions. All right. Next, we have an item from Reuters. Delta Boeing clash threatens Obama bid to renew Ex-Im Bank. Now, this article says that concerns raised by Delta Airlines about the fairness of U.S. export-import bank loans to help Boeing export aircraft are complicating President Barack Obama's push to quickly renew the bank's charter. So first, Dan, maybe for the benefit of all of our listeners, you could explain what's an Ex-Im Bank, and then we can get into why does Delta care about this.
Sure. A bunch of countries, obviously carriers like countries like the U.S. might be bigger than others for aerospace, but obviously every country is interested in participating in global commerce and encouraging an export sector. And the U.S. Ex-Im Bank, the Export-Import Bank, is one way that happens. And basically it helps provide financing to foreign companies when they're buying American products. And obviously, aerospace falls into that, especially here in the U.S., considering I think Boeing is the largest exporter in the country, yes? Or if it's not the largest, it's certainly up there.
Yes, and has been historically, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So the issue of aircraft finance, especially when governments get involved, is always a little bit hairy. And it was kind of addressed a while ago when there is this concept called the home market rule, which is basically this agreement that the government really wouldn't provide financing to European airlines when they're buying U.S. aircraft and vice versa. And that kind of worked because you had Boeing and Airbus and the biggest carriers in the world really were in those home markets in Europe and the U.S. But times have changed, and we've had carriers, especially in areas like the Middle East, really grow. And this has kind of made airlines like Delta and I believe previously the Air Transport Association, but now Airlines for America, they haven't been happy about this because in this global environment where you could have an airline like Delta going up against a foreign carrier, airlines like Delta, their position is that these foreign airlines have an unfair advantage because they can get cheap financing from the government, and they're given an unfair advantage versus other airlines. So this is kind of falling into the traditional Republican-Democrat line, with a lot of Republicans saying that this is, you know, the government shouldn't be meddling here, whereas the Democrats kind of support it, because it's an interesting issue, because it's on one hand, you don't want to, in my opinion, you don't want to hurt domestic airlines, but obviously with Boeing being such a huge company that, and not only Boeing employs so many people, but if you go out through the whole supply chain, has a huge economic impact. You don't want to hurt them as well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. Though according to who said that, hon? sorry.
Well, Dan, while you're fumbling for an answer.
Oh, God, thank you. I already figured it
I'm
out.
I'm sorry. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
How about a question? I mean, we're talking about the interest rates that Delta's complaining about right now that might be part of the Ex-Im Bank's financing. What have they been traditionally? I mean, have they been so egregiously different that that this has been going on? Is this issue new, or is this just something that's coming up prior to the election?
Actually, it's been going on for a while. This is just the latest round, and I think the two issues that have brought this up are, number one, the kind of just changing with the emergence of foreign carriers that aren't in the home markets of Boeing and Airbus, but especially in 2008, at the end of 2008-09, when we had this the whole financial crisis, and a lot of foreign airlines would be able to tap these government sources of credit, whereas other airlines were stuck with just tapping the regular market, where it could be harder to obtain financing, especially financing at a lower price.
Is it the price, Dan, or is it just the availability of the credit? I mean, that's what, with credit being so constrained right now, the capital markets being so constrained, it's just finding a source of this amount of capital is what is such a challenge. And to have the Ex-Im Bank providing these at increasingly higher credit ceilings, it's an advantage or an opportunity for these rapidly expanding international carriers to do so.
I think it's a little bit of both. And according to one senator quoted in the article, there is some kind of agreement on, unfortunately, the article really doesn't go that in depth about using market rates for this financing, which should address it, at least the price part, but it could still, the availability aspect, as you mentioned, could still be a little bit hairy.
Okay. It's interesting to watch how the balance is shifting. You know, 20 years ago,
yes,
would Boeing have dared, you know, would we see this type of conflict between them and one of their key customers, what then was a key customer?
Yeah, probably not likely.
No. Boy, it's really interesting how the world is changing.
It has.
Yeah.
Yeah, money will do that, I guess, or rates.
Well,
yeah.
Well, think of it. I think, I'm pretty sure Emirates is has been able to use this financing, and they're a major customer as well. I think actually that Flight Global article about the 777X actually mentioned that Emirates operates 1 in 10 777s.
Right.
So
yes, yeah, it all comes together.
But yeah, it certainly changed, considering especially back before the McDonnell Douglas merger, and Delta was one of the airlines, along with Continental and American, to sign an exclusivity agreement with Boeing. Hmm. They are that important a customer.
Yeah, I guess in general, this topic makes my head hurt, because the more I think about sort of the interplay of the different parties and governments and companies and airlines involved, and as well as, you know, others in the marketplace providing capital, other aircraft financing companies and things like that, you know, how all this fits together is such that it's a level playing field is really hard to imagine. I don't know how all that works.
Sometimes it seems that the whole political environment surrounding aircraft sales is more complex than the technology in the airplane itself.
For sure. Yeah, no doubt. Okay. Let's close out the news with kind of a sad note. This is from the Herald Tribune. Two Venice couples and child killed in North Carolina plane crash. And this was a recent crash of a Cessna Citation. I think it was trying to land at Macon County Airport in Franklin, North Carolina. Is that right, Rob? Rob's on mute. Rob has left the building.
No, I'm playing a David on you there. the citation was actually trying to land at the Macon County Airport, as you said, and we don't know why yet, but I did have a chat with a couple of people on the airport. There were a couple of witnesses to the accident, and then I talked to the NTSB investigator as well. That's on the scene right now, and it seems it's going to be pretty tough. My guess is to make this thing anything other than pilot error, because the pilot was very high coming across the approach end of the runway. The witness that I saw that is not a pilot but is somebody that's worked at the airport for years said he thought he was at least 2,000 feet above the ground coming across the numbers, which means there's no way in the world you could get the thing down on a 5,000-foot runway. So what the pilot apparently decided to do, which was rather than just go around and sort of make a traditional box pattern and come back in and land, he just kind of wrapped it over into a tight turn, which turned into a spiral, which meant it was a very steep turn, and he picked up a lot of speed, and he kind of rolled out over the end of the runway, still somewhat high, but very, very fast. And he tried to force the thing down onto the runway to get it stopped. And he struck first on the nose gear, and the airplane bounced back up in the air. And it sounds from what the witnesses said on the noise of the engines that the pilot tried to go around, but he lost control of the airplane. The right wing caught the ground, and it just cartwheeled and blew up. And again, two people. Two couples and the young child were all killed really instantaneously. I mean, they said it blew up almost as the wing first began to come unglued there. So it's pretty sad. And I guess what is also kind of sad, though, is that this was a single pilot citation. Now, there are some versions of the citation that are certified to be flown single pilot because they are considered to be simple enough to operate. But in this particular case, the pilot didn't have a lot of time. I mean, that's something, Steve can listen in on too, certainly. I mean, this pilot had 1,100 hours total time, and wow. I believe just under 200 in the citation total. That was the extent of his jet time. And you just don't do this kind of maneuver in a jet. You just don't. Actually, you wouldn't even do it in a 172, but you sure don't do it in a jet, and they really paid the price.
So what's the, maybe it's too early, but is there a lesson in this at this point?
Well, the lesson is that the pilot, if anything, I mean, we have to ask whether there should be any kind of limits to when someone is certified to fly a jet single pilot. Just because you can pass the rating and you meet the requirements doesn't necessarily mean that you're safe. But of course, the lesson is very similar to what happens when single engine airplanes lose an engine on takeoff. Very often people are killed when they try to turn back for the runway. There are just maneuvers in airplanes that you just cannot do. Turning back for the runway when you lose the engine in a single engine airplane and making steep turns like it's an aerobatic airplane in a jet. You just can't get away with that kind of stuff.
All right, again, our guest this episode is Steve Fulton, a technical fellow with GE Aviation. I love that title. Is that your actual title, Steve, or if we got that right, technical fellow?
Yeah. It just says that I can't manage people, so they put me on a technical track.
I love it. Sounds great.
Yeah. You know the story of big companies, the normal tracks are management tracks that people begin to accumulate more and more responsibility, and they're rewarded for that.
Right.
And sometime way back, companies got pretty smart and said, why do we take technical people and try to make them managers? Let's develop a track that's parallel, that's an engineering track, that they can be successful and be rewarded for what they can contribute, and not try to make people who aren't interested or aren't gifted at managing, try to make them managers. So
yes.
I'm in that track. I'm in the technical track.
And actually, we have exactly the same kind of thing. Steve, since last time we talked, several things have happened. We have an FAA bill now that is in place, something long term. Is that good news for RNP?
Definitely. I mean, if you look at the reauthorization bill and what was provided in it, you know, it's created some aggressive deadlines for deployment of RNP and RNAF, which is a little bit lesser animal of the same ilk. So the FAA has been given guidance by Congress that spells out in very specific time frames what needs to be done. There's a schedule for implementation, for instance, at 35 non-Metroplex airports over the next 5 years. And there's a similar schedule for at busy airports over 3 years. So one thing that's really difficult, I think a challenge for the FAA, is to deploy systems, complex systems, and be accountable for benefits. And so this is the thing to watch about this bill. There are performance metrics that are in place along with the schedules that set the stage for the whatever the FAA does to be beneficial. And this has been, I think, an increasing concern from a lot of the users, a lot of the stakeholders is, hey, there's a lot of activity, but to what end? You know, where is the benefit? And, you know, if you look typically how historically the FAA has done things, you know, they'll deploy radar systems, they'll deploy, right now they're deploying ADS-B. The metrics typically are to have certain types of systems or units deployed by a certain date. And it's assumed that those benefits, or it's implied with those schedules, that the benefits will flow. Well, this is a little bit more complex. You can't get benefits unless you take care in the deployment process to ensure that you're actually doing something that achieves the desired result. And I think this has been a really wise move on the part of Congress.
So is the congressional mandate...
Whoa. Wise? It's possible they can do something like that?
you know, there's lots of things that we can say either for or against the FAA, and it's easy to throw rocks. But let's just acknowledge that the system that we have here in the United States has been here for a while. The infrastructure is quite mature. The system's quite complex. There's a lot of traffic and, you know, a lot of moving parts. And so to change it is complicated. It's difficult work. Now, on the other hand, you could say, well, is the FAA doing enough? And this is where GE has communicated clearly. We've been working for quite a period of time. We started in 2006 communicating with the FAA that we had had the opportunity to work outside the United States and other countries to deploy systems. We'd be given a lot of... Well, we had been qualified or gone through a process of being qualified and authorized to do that work, and it seemed to be working very well. Could we do something like that here in the United States? So we began working with the FAA, and another company, Boeing's Jeppesen, came along with us, and together we worked with the FAA, and we developed this process where we could be qualified to help do this deployment work. And so this is where I think the bill is really interesting is, not only are they setting out the schedules and defining the performance metrics, but they're also providing some direction to the FAA to use more than just their typical resources. What they've said is, and the words that are used often are third party. We're defined as a third party, a non-FAA entity.
Sure.
The words are to use third parties to help accelerate these benefits.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes sense. You know, when the work is big and complex, it just makes sense to engage all available resources to try to get the end result moved forward, to advance those dates, advance those benefits, and to bring some more relief sooner than what we've seen.
So the congressional mandate includes more than just what to accomplish. It sounds like it includes some aspects of how to accomplish that. Is that
it
accurate?
Does. Yeah, it does. So, for instance, you know, one of the things that we've been doing outside the United States is working an outside-in strategy. We've worked in some of the more remote areas. you know, we're really well known. The work that I did originally at Alaska Airlines was in a remote airport. Juneau was the start of that. And then, you know, the team there at Alaska built out, you know, a number of other airports. And as we worked at Navris, Navris was founded in 2003. Again, we started repeating that model. We went to the places that were simpler from an air traffic standpoint, very complex from a technical, challenging, you know, lots of mountainous terrain and so forth. But there you can develop some important principles that then you can advance to the next step. And the next step for us was in 2007, we switched on the air traffic operation in Brisbane. And this is what I talked to you the time that I was on before.
Yes.
Here you had an environment that was not a Juneau, not a Queenstown, which is a remote place on the south end of New Zealand, or Lhasa, these places in Tibet. It's a relatively complex airspace in operation with 22 or so international airlines flying in and out, and traffic densities on the size of a San Diego, Kansas City, Dallas Love, you know, these types of airports we have in our country. And the question there was, could we put these advanced procedures into that airspace without it being disruptive? And it's not just a haphazard attempt. It was a very systematic, step-by-step, bringing the airplane capability, bringing capability that was already in place with the air traffic management system that they have there in Australia. And by the way, we have the same here in the United States. As a matter of fact, ours is a little bit more advanced. And yet, working with the people, the controllers, putting the right procedures in place, getting the right training, the right operational rules of engagement. And that's been operating since 2007 with some pretty amazing results. So the question is, step by step by step, moving from that outside or remote to a more complex, can we learn those incremental lessons and bring them to the United States to have an effect? And we're confident that we can. And I think Congress is confident that there's more than just FAA resources available. And so that's what that language in the bill is saying. We published a study last April, and I think this was after the last time we did this show. It was called the Highways in the Sky study. And what we attempted to do in that study and what it says is that there are significant benefits at airports that are not at the top of the priority list for the FAA. The constituents of the FAA, the airlines, the constituents for this technology anyway right now, let me say, would be the airlines. They have been pushing, and there's been activities like the Radio Technical Committee or the RTCA Task Force 5 that came up with a list of recommendations. It pushes the FAA into the most complex airspace because that's where the most pain is right now. You know, it's the Chicago's, the New York area airports, Atlanta, the Southern California airports. And we as a company and we as a technical team at our company have been watching this with some concern because certainly we would not, I think, choose that as our starting place where we would want to learn and begin to work with all of the stakeholders who have never done this type of thing and try to learn our way through the problems.
Because it's too much, too fast?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, we may have some technical solutions, but there's so much of the human element in this.
Yeah,
you have to understand that we're asking controllers to go from something which they've done from the beginning of controlling time, which is vectoring. When they had radar systems put in place, they began to radar vector and provide guidance to airplanes. And then, of course, as we got more advanced, they become very, very good at vectoring. And they can load a runway to a maximum, you know, landing capacity very well. But it comes at a pretty high cost from an efficiency standpoint. We're pushing the airplanes down low. We're leveling them off. We got the gear out, the flaps out, the power's going up and down. And we're getting these airplanes slotted on this long extended final, dragging them in sometimes fully configured for 15 miles, and yet it works. But it's not what we know we could do if we bring a more strategic managed arrival system. And so we want the airplanes to be, as I described at the start of the show, on these predefined paths that from top of descent, the power comes back to idle, and the airplane begins a descent with a specific spot, a sequence already predetermined of where it would be in the landing sequence, and its touchdown time already predetermined very precisely for that runway.
Wow.
And to do that, of course, it's not a technical challenge only. It's also a human change, a process in how people do their – a change in how people do their jobs. And this is the part that is, I would say, non-trivial. Humans, by nature, we don't like to change. We hold on to our old ways. I mean, just listen to how we talk. We say, remember when, and we always look back at whatever it was that we're talking about as it was the greatest times ever,
sure,
even though it might have been, you know, not so great.
Yeah.
So it's just we have a sentimentality about us that really enjoys these ways. And I have to say, as a pilot, when I was flying for Alaska Airlines, flying up and down the Southeast Coast, there was no finer job for scheduled airline service. You're off radar. You're flying NDB, back course, LDA offsets. You know, sometimes you're several miles from the airport at the missed approach point, and you have to fly the airplane. Mm. You got your hands on the stick and the hands on the thrust levers, and you're doing some really interesting flying. It's very challenging, takes a lot of training, and so forth. We transitioned the pilot group at Alaska from that to this managed concept where the airplane's automation is flying this predetermined path and the pilots are stepping back one level and managing the automation. And so that is no insignificant thing to ask controllers to do, to step back from the hands-on radar vectoring task to one that's using automation and managing that automation to sequence these airplanes very precisely and much more efficiently. Our friends in Australia say that, you know, when they were working with their controllers and training their controllers in Brisbane, they said, you know, well, first of all, they said that trying to teach a controller not to vector an airplane is like trying to tell a dog not to chase a car. And that's just what they do. and so part of the course that they ran these guys through was, remember, when you vector an airplane, it's something you do to it, not for it. You're doing something to that airplane, not for it, when you vector. You're interrupting its efficiency. So in this study, just getting back to that for a minute, this Highways in the Sky study, what we had identified was, here's these airports that are not on that top priority list of the FAA. And we picked 46 airports. And at those 46 airports, there's 12 airlines that fly to those airports that are fully equipped with all of the necessary gear on the airplanes. The pilots are already trained. They already have the authorization from the FAA to do these RMP operations, these RMP-AR operations, which are the higher performance procedures that were of interest in the study. And we said, okay, of these airports, what would be the annual benefits if we deployed over a three-year period of time, which we think we could do, procedures at all those airports, what would it look like? And by our analysis, we showed 13 million gallons of fuel being saved per year, which equated to about $66 million of economic benefit to the airlines. Hmm. And that's going to keep changing, of course, as fuel prices go up. But more importantly, or increasingly more importantly, is this this understanding of what the carbon emissions are doing in the environment. And there's a 275-million-pound reduction of CO2, and the flying time reduction by having these airplanes go through the airspace more quickly, more efficiently, you know, without all the long finals and delays and so forth, equates to 747 days of flying time for that aggregate number of flights into those 46 airports. So I think this study has had its effect. What we see in this reauthorization bill is Congress directing FAA to not only work at these more complex airports. You know, if the FAA is successful there, let's be clear, the benefits are going to be huge.
Sure.
You know, it's high risk, but also high reward. But perhaps we could parallel that effort with this other activity that would address, you know, similar concerns, lesser overall quantity of benefit, but certainly not insignificant benefit. And we would say, and the study would say, that by being successful in these less complex airspaces, we'll have done our part in contributing to the to the knowledge pool of what it takes to be successful at the more complex airspace. You know, word spreads pretty fast. When you get a controller in maybe Salt Lake City or Portland or New Orleans or one of these airports that was in the study who has begun to make that transition and maybe fully transition and sees how this thing is working, you know, that spreads pretty quickly through controller ranks, and it can have its effect. Just as we've been able to be effective with our pilot groups that are flying, we get the pilots that are across that transition talking to pilots who haven't made that transition, and it's very effective when you have a pilot-to-pilot communication going on.
Now, Steve, I think this kind of goes to some of your prior points, but Southwest in their annual report, and Southwest has, I think, you know, it's better than I has been kind of a leader in this area, it seems. And they started R&P operation in January 2011. In the first 20 days, they said they operated about 1,400 R&P approaches. But for the whole year, it was just under 6,800. And they were saying by the end of the year, they're flying less than 400 R&P approaches by month. And I think over 300 of their 737-700s are equipped for R&P. And they're saying that approaches for the FAA isn't putting out approaches fast enough. And also at airports with R&P approaches, they're not even getting clearance to fly them. So how do we fix that?
Yeah, that's a real problem, Dan. You know, what a tragedy to have all of this effort expended to have, you know, Southwest is a relatively newcomer in terms of, you know, R&P time to this R&P business, but they have made a huge bet. They've put, you know, many millions of dollars into their upgrade of the airplanes, their pilot training, and they've been very systematic about the pilot training. Whenever an airline looks at bringing a new operational concept in, and this is a pretty dramatic change, you know, as we understand, Southwest was a fairly basic airline in terms of keeping things very simple in the cockpit. Lots of stick and rudder and hand flying type of, not hand flying, but a lot of manual functions being done by the pilots that things like auto throttles, lateral nav, vertical nav that are now switched on would be doing instead. So to transition across that great divide, Southwest was very strategic in laying out careful plans. And the team there at Southwest in Dallas did a nice job of, you know, planning that and providing to the FAA the necessary information that would convince the FAA that they could get that qualification done and be fully capable and qualified. So when they switched this on, which was January, I think, of 2011, that was when they went live with this, that was not the beginning for them. It was actually just another step in something that had begun several years before. You know, it was a large amount of effort that was below the waterline that we maybe don't fully appreciate. But what many have said, you know, as Southwest was doing that work and the FAA was doing the procedure design work, there was a pretty significant gap in what was being done to get the controllers prepared. You know, understand that this is every bit as important for a controller to fully embrace with all of the training, you know, the information, the qualification, the guidance, all of that stuff is just as important for a controller as it is for a pilot. And, you know, there's anecdotal comments made around the industry from people who I think should know, and so I'll just accept it at face value, that, you know, some instances, pilots were asking for procedures that the controllers weren't even fully aware what they were. And so maybe they were cleared one or two times, and then concerns developed, and then they stopped being cleared. And it doesn't take pilots very long. If it doesn't work, they're not going to keep asking. You know, if the results are the same, why keep asking the same question? And so the data right now at Southwest, it's not clear whether this reduction in actual procedures being flown per month, if it's a function of that, of controllers not clearing, or pilots perhaps encountering some uncomfortable or dislike with the procedures and saying, no, I don't want to fly that, let's do this other thing, and not asking for their own reasons. But the
Steve,
anecdotal,
can I
evidence,
ask something?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, a controller, well, I've talked to a couple of them over the years about this, and one of the concepts that they always fear is that if this gets organized well enough, that they won't need as many controllers. So it's, you know, kind of a job security thing. And of course, over the years, I've said, well, you know, the automation hasn't cut down on the pilot ranks. I mean, I doubt seriously they're going to get rid of a whole bunch of people in one fell swoop here, because R&P and those kinds of things suddenly came to be. I mean, have you ever heard that kind of concern yourself, or has anybody ever expressed anything like that?
Yeah, I've heard that. I've never heard anybody say, you know, in the active work inside the inner circles I've been part of, I've never heard anybody say that was an objective. And in fact, let's be really clear that NATCA is playing a key role in all this activity right now. The National Air Traffic Controller Association, they have representatives. They've got a great staff of people. And my impression working with these folks, it's like working with pilots. These guys want to do a really good job. They want that airplane to fly efficiently. They want it to come in and out of the airport using the least amount of energy, making the least amount of emissions and the lowest amount of noise. They're looking for, you know, someone to help them. They're looking for the right tools to do it properly. And so the biggest concern, I think, that we have for controllers right now is just, it's the typical concern you'd have with any transition. You know, what is it we're getting ourselves into? And can I buy into this? Is it going to be equivalent to what I've had in terms of what I feel like is a safe operation? And so that's something that's really, really important. Working with pilots, one of the things when I was at Alaska Airlines, I was really, really careful to never put something in front of a pilot that didn't work exactly as advertised. You know, we go and work with regulators around the world. Regulators have their, you know, they have their processes, they have their regulations, their standards, they monitor for compliance. I mean, they're a tough customer, and we take it seriously, and we work really hard to make sure that all of their questions are answered and that they're fully confident that we're doing the right things. But there is no harsher critic, no tougher judge of anything than a controller or a pilot. You know, so you may find something,
yeah, agreed.
You may find something that passes some certification standard, but you put it into a cockpit. Rob, you've probably seen this. Something that may be compliant, but it's not reliable, or it's not, it doesn't connect with the operation in a way that is seamless. You know, it's a disruption. These are things that you can never lose those folks. If you put something in front of them and it doesn't work as advertised or do what they think it should do, you've lost a tremendous amount of capital, and it's hard to get it back.
Well, but don't you run the same risk, or not you, but I'm saying, doesn't Southwest run the same risk with shareholders, that eventually shareholders will say, look, we spent all this money to put all this technology in these airplanes, and it's not being used the way that everyone had expected and saving us what we thought it would. What are we going to do with this here?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Rob. Obviously, this comment that Dan has brought forward was in the, I think it was in the 10-K filing, wasn't it, Dan?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so they're communicating to their shareholders that things are not on schedule. And, I mean, it's a business, right? So you have to be really clear that this investment was made against a business case that had a return that was estimated at some number. And if you're not making that return, hey, somebody's got to answer for that. And this is something that all of us from the very beginning, when Southwest made this decision, the FAA, ourselves in industry, we said we cannot let this fail. Because if it does, you know, we've lost a generation of business people who are willing to invest in next gen.
Yeah.
I mean, next gen is a big program. It's the flagship program for the FAA right now. And if we're not successful in getting the results that are promised, it's going to be a real hard time getting people to come back.
Well, so Steve, make the connection then for listeners about this program with Southwest and this delay in the authorization and how it slowed NextGen down and how one may have affected the other. I mean, if there is a case.
So you're saying how did the reauthorization language develop perhaps as a result of what?
Well, no, what I was saying is, you know, we've been in this holding mode with the reauthorization bill for years. And I'm just wondering if there was fallout into, say, implementation of something like R&P because of all this craziness with no one being completely certain where NextGen was headed.
Well, this has been certainly a concern is, you know, all this talk, NextGen's been in motion now for, what, 11 or 12 years. Where's the proof in the pudding? And as the delay continues, the lack of benefit continues, as voices in the industry who are starting to get early deployments are expressing their displeasure, yeah, there's a lot of pressure building. We had the administrator in Cincinnati last Tuesday. He was there to visit GE Aviation. And we put him in a simulator to show him a concept that we think would work very well here in the United States. I was down in Peru in February and was on board in the cockpit with the LAN pilots as we launched a really important next step. You know, we talk about the milestones earlier coming from places like Juneau, moving into more complex airspace like Brisbane. What was done in Peru is, in my mind, the next step beyond that, and that's taking an airport like a Juneau and connect it with an airport like Brisbane. So you've got the remote connected with a seamless route right into a busy airport. And in 2009, LAN had worked with us, and we had deployed a full set of procedures into Cusco. If you ever go to Machu Picchu on a tour there, you fly into Cusco. It's the closest airport, but it's a really challenging airport. It's the typical remote airport with all the mountainous terrain. And yet it was like any other remote airport we've done. You know, it had the ins and outs, and then you transitioned to normal airspace and did your own thing beyond. But working with LAN beginning in early 2011, we kicked off this project that they've called Green Skies of Peru. And the inauguration of that was just on the February 23rd. And what we have now is the routes that come off the runway at Cusco. So you come off a runway 10 at Cusco, and it's a route that understands where all of the terrain is, and you respect those constraints. And then as soon as you can, as the airplane's climbing, you point the nose of the airplane right directly at Lima, 350 miles away. And you're on this beeline for Lima, and you got the efficient climb going, the unrestricted climb. Then at cruise altitude, you're cruising along, and then you have the ability to start a descent when you're cleared for the approach to Lima. You start an approach that brings the airplane back into an idle path descent, and you fly this arrival that takes the airplane on a downwind, and it's got a curved path and joins the final, and you're on the ground. And there's a tremendous amount of value in this type of project from an industry perspective in that, you know, now we're looking at airplanes that are coming from 350 miles away and understanding in advance where they're going to fit into that arrival slot and getting the controller community, that air traffic control community, to start transitioning from that control mindset to this management mindset, to anticipate in advance this airplane's coming, and where are we going to put it? So we had the administrator in the cockpit of the simulator. We flew this whole flight and said, hey, when we talk about doing these airports, these 35 non-Metroplex airports in the United States,
right,
let's connect those airports. And take Salt Lake City, for instance. You know, Salt Lake City flights go in and out to different places around in Idaho and different places in Utah and Montana. You could easily do a Cusco to Lima type of operation and take that next step here in the United States beyond what maybe we've done so far with just the standalone airports, whether they're complex or not.
Okay, this is really fascinating. We're running a little bit long, so we need to kind of start to wrap it up. Steve, maybe you could mention what happens next.
What happens next here in the United States? We haven't talked about the appropriation bill yet.
This is where the bill comes, the money. You want money,
well, yeah,
right?
So, yeah, exactly. So there's the reauthorization bill, which was passed here, I think, in February. The appropriation bill was passed late last fall. And in the appropriation bill, there's $5 million provided. It's $3 million provided for five airports. And what Congress is saying is, hey, we've got Boeing and GE here saying that they're in this business. They've got this ability to help. We've got this study that GE did that says we've got all these benefits of these airports. Let's go validate both the third-party concept as well as these benefits they're talking about at these airports. And so what's going to happen next, maybe as soon as the next couple weeks, we're expecting to see the FAA pull the trigger on this and to see a contract or a move towards a contract to get these five airports going. The appropriations bill said that work would be done by the end of 2012, and we're in March already. So the clock is ticking, and we're obviously really excited about this. We've been, in some respects, sitting on the bench, you know, like the kid at the football game in high school, all suited up, ready to go, but the coach hadn't given us the ball yet. So we're hoping to get that call on this one.
Okay, very good. Steve, it's been fascinating. We want to really thank you for taking the time to join us and have this conversation. We, as with last time, we just learned so much from this conversation.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to say, and Max, you're welcome, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to be back, but we've been talking almost entirely about airlines here. And I know, Dan, this is a real interest of yours. It's certainly one of mine. My background is, most recent background is airline flying. But most of us have come up through general aviation. I still fly a small airplane, and I learned how to fly. I'm not a military pilot. Little grass strips and fabric and tube airplanes is where I came from. I'm really concerned that we're not connecting with the general aviation community on this. I've talked to Pete Bunce at Gamma and other manufacturers within Gamma about a real need to communicate how these benefits of RMP translate to a general aviation population. And it's about airspace access. It's about getting in and out of some of these airports that are close to major metropolitan airports. And the airspace, of course, today is so restrictive, it's hard to do that without being without getting the unwelcome message through the radio. Anyway, so that would be something I would challenge you guys to maybe kick around and think about. How do you, in your efforts and in your conversations in the future, maybe look at broadening this view? Certainly, we're active at GE in doing that. I've been to Oshkosh talking to the audience there. But if we're not working as a broad community of users in this airspace, then we're missing a big opportunity. It's not just an airline application. It's a general aviation, and I would say a unmanned aircraft application as well.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, getting airplanes on these defined tracks and begin to coordinate them in strategic ways is the path to the future.
Steve, again, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to having
really cool
more conversations with you in the future.
Thank you, Max. And I look forward to seeing you guys at the air shows coming up. Maybe, if not Oshkosh, one of the other ones. I don't know if anybody's going to be at Farnborough, but always fun to connect with you guys. I saw the guys from the Australia desk at Australia. Rob, I saw you there, and Dan. So look forward to that at Oshkosh this year. Yeah, so if anybody wants to hear more about what we've been talking about, I write for our GE Aviation Skyward blog, and I also am on Twitter. Twitter handle is CAPT, Steve Fulton. CAP as in Captain Steve Fulton.
And now with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode Number 11, March 18th to March 24th. March 18th, 1963, Dassault Aviation's Balzac 5 makes a successful transition from vertical takeoff to horizontal flight. The Balzac 5 took its name from a local famous telephone exchange at the time. The Balzac was based on the Mirage 3. The Mirage's ATAR engine was replaced by the non-afterburning or non-reheating, for the Commonwealth folks, Orpheus engine. Vertical lift was provided by not one, but eight Rolls-Royce RB-108 lift engines. The lift engines were grouped in pairs around the center of gravity, and the aircraft had two fatal crashes before it was discontinued in 1965. On March 19, 1941, the United States Army Air Corps activates the 99th Pursuit Squadron. Activation was on 211 The activation was 271 enlisted personnel at Chanute Field, Illinois. Those 271 were trained separately from the other soldiers on the base. They also had completely segregated living areas, messes, and barracks. The reason was the 99th were colored. The 99th would eventually get a cadre of pilots when they were transferred to the Tuskegee, Alabama. The Red Tails, as they would eventually become known, were one of the most successful military squadrons in the European theater of operations. They were the front lines of desegregation for the United States military. March 24th, 1843. Yes, 1843. William S. Henson and John Stringfellow files Articles of Incorporation for the Aerial Transit Corporation. The intention of the new company to build a steam-powered flying machine called Ariel. The company was going to use the aircraft to deliver letters, packages, and passengers by air for a fee. The Ariel was not successful, but Henson and Stringfellow were ahead of their time, making their first incorporated airline. The aircraft of the week, the Douglas TBD-1 Devastator. On June 30, 1934, the Naval Bureau of Aeronautics ordered a torpedo bomber to replace the then-current Martin BM-2s and Great Lake TG-2s. The specification stated a Bliss-Levitt Mark 8 torpedo or three 500-pound bombs were to be carried. The power plant selected was the Pratt Whitney XR-1830-60 that was an air-cooled radial developing 900 horsepower. It was to have a crew of three. Eventually, the aircraft would become the come out would be the Great Lakes XTBG-1, which would be the last biplane the Navy would seriously evaluate. The Douglas Corporation entered a monoplane. The TBD would become the first monoplane with widespread use in the Navy. The wing itself was the first to have a power-actuated hydraulic wings, which folded vertically over the cockpit. The cockpit was completely enclosed, which was another first for the U.S. Navy. The landing gear retracted into the wings, however, the wheels were not completely enclosed. 10 inches of the wheels would protrude down so that if the wheels up landing occurred, there would be minimal damage. This feature was found on two other Douglas aircrafts, the SBDs and the DC-3 family. The crew of three consisted of a pilot who sat in front, a rear gunner, and radio operator who would be in the very back of the greenhouse canopy. Lastly, the bombardier sat in the middle. During a torpedo attack, the bombardier would slide down prone through a tunnel under the pilot. He would open a pair of doors so he could look through the forward-facing glass under the engine. For sighting, he would use the legendary Norton bomb sight. The primary weapon of the aircraft was the Bliss-Levitt Mark 13 torpedo. The Mark 13 was 13 feet 5 inches long and 22 inches in diameter. It was 1,200 pounds, most of which was 1,000 pounds of explosives. The torpedo ran at 33 knots, or 60 miles an hour, for 6,300 yards. Its defensive armament was rearward firing, a 30-inch gun with another forward-firing one. The forward-firing position fired through the arc of the propeller using a timing mechanism. In the early stages of World War II, the TBD had successes in the Gilberts, Wake Island, and Marcus Islands. However, those successes would quickly disappear. The largest contributor to this was the Mark 13 torpedo, which quite often failed to explode on impact or would run deep and go right underneath the target ship. At the Battle of Midway Island, 41 TBDs were launched. The Devastator would be devastated in this battle. A torpedo attack is the ultimate gauntlet flying, much like Luke did in the Death Star battle. To successfully drop a Mark 13 torpedo, you must fly no more than 115 miles an hour, and you couldn't fly higher than 50 feet off the water. To be most effective, you needed to fly a long, straight, level path directly into the broadside of your target. At Midway, 41 of the aircraft launched by VT-6, VT-8, and VT-3, only 6 returned to the carriers. While not one of the TBDs at Midway hit their designated targets, the Japanese fleet and its Zero fighters were so focused on the TBDs, it allowed another Douglas product, the SBD, slow but deadly, dive bombers, to attack unharassed. The SBD would sink 4 Japanese carriers that day and become the hero of Midway. The most famous TBD pilot was Ensign George H. Gay, Jr. Gay was part of Torpedo Squadron 8. At the time, the squadron was based off the Hornet, and Gay was aboard the Hornet when the B-25 Tokyo Raiders took off from its deck. Gay was the first of Torpedo 8 to launch toward its target, the Imperial Japanese Navy carrier Kaga. When flying down the barrels of Kaga's guns, the Mark 13 missed the target. Gay was wounded and his radio man was dying in the rear. He pulled up and flew down the length of Kaga's flight deck. He almost decided to crash his aircraft in the deck, but then thought twice. Instead, he flew away hoping to reach Hornet. On his way back, five Zeros jumped his aircraft, and the crippled aircraft forced Gay to land and ditch in the water. Gay then would spend the next 6 hours hiding under a seat cushion to avoid being strafed by the Japanese Zeros. Gay would spend the day right in the middle of the Japanese fleet. He personally watched the destruction of Kaga, Soyu, and Akagi. He would later retort that story to Admiral Chester Nimitz. Gay's 30 hours of floating at sea would end when a PBY Catalina picked him up. Of the 30 men who launched with VT-8, it was only Gay who survived the mission. Gay was awarded the Navy Cross, the Purple Heart, a Presidential Citation, and the Air Medal for his actions at Midway. Gay died in 1994, and his ashes were dispersed with his squadron mates at the location where he ditched in 1942. Midway was the end of the TBD's career. It was quickly replaced by the Grumman TBF Avenger. There are no surviving TBDs of the 103 that were built. There are several wrecks. Some might be salvaged from the depths, but that hasn't happened yet. The only other variant of the TBD was the TBD-1A, which had 2 Edo floats built for it. It was a successful float plan, however, no prototype was ever built. The Devastator started as state-of-the-art and ended behind the times 7 years later, which shows you how quickly obsolescence occurred in the late 30s and 40s. So for next week, we'll run the randomizer, and the winner is... the Lockheed Jetstar, or the C-140. And that's the way it was, March 18th to March 24th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing out.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
So we have Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren joining us live from Australia right now. Guys, what's going on down in your neck of the woods? Any interesting aviation goings on?
Are you there, Grant? Have you got the story list up, Grant?
I'm working on it. Okay. It's so right, long, it's taking forever to load. How many hours have we got, Max?
Well, fear okay. Not, Max. Ready tomorrow here. So anyway, let's go ahead with this first one, Grant. Virgin Australia moves ahead with its restructure. Qantas still not happy about it, though.
Oh, that's correct, mate. Basically, Virgin's going to split itself into two. One part will be purely domestic and fully open to 100% ownership by foreign entities if required. The other part will be the international airline holdings, and it will be available to have international ownership of about 49%, which is pretty much where it's at the moment now for Virgin. And what this means is that they'll keep their international airline operating in this separate holding entity that's under separate management and so on, while the domestic one can be up to 100% owned by foreign entities, which allows them to get all sorts of investment money in to help them improve what they're doing. I mean, they're already getting a profit right now. The whole operation's turning a profit, and that's even allowing for them expanding and getting into this business market. So Borghetti's business plan for Virgin is definitely paying off at this stage.
Borghetti, as we said a couple of weeks ago, he's got a lot of flexibility when it comes to this because he's not bound like Qantas is by the Qantas Sale Act, and Qantas is not able to restructure this way. I mean, I'm sure they'd like to.
Oh, they're not happy about it, mate. They're not happy about it.
Yeah, they've made a submission to the International Air Services Commission calling for a comprehensive public review of Virgin's plans, which were announced last month. And if they go ahead, they'll go ahead at the end of this month. That's March. So we'll see what happens there. But, it always makes for a lot of good news here. It fills up our content list, so that's good.
Yeah, and it's going to bring out some slinging because it's pretty much what Qantas have been trying to do surreptitiously under the board, whereas Virgin's just up and announced, hey, we're doing it. We're being really open about it. By the way, we're still doing all this stuff in Australia, so don't worry. It's fascinating.
Moving on to the other big story here this week, aviation-wise, Grant, and speaking of Qantas again, the A380 that had all that trouble over Indonesia a couple of years ago, the Nancy Bird Walton, which is the registration VHOQA, they've spent a lot of money, in fact, $135 million Australian dollars repairing that aircraft, and looks like it's finally going to be heading home next month.
That's right, mate. Oscar Quebec Alpha. Good old Nancy Bird Walton, the first A380 that Qantas ever got, back in the air again in April, coming back to Australia. Just like QF1 that went off the end of the runway in Bangkok, the guys have decided this one's a repairable, even though it's very expensive, it's better to repair it. They've done that, and pretty intensive, mate. It's been almost a couple of years, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, at least 18 months. I know that that aircraft has been grounded over there in Asia this whole time while they've been replacing it. I think they've had to replace the entire wing, I'm pretty sure. We've covered that pretty extensively over the last year or so. But interesting to see that they didn't write that engine off. They didn't write that aircraft off. In fact, they're bringing it back into service. And interestingly enough, Grant, those are Rolls-Royce engines. They've had a lot of issues there that they've had to sort out with them. And I was just looking at another website today, the Centre for Aviation. They've got pop-up ads. And I noticed, interestingly, that there's a pop-up ad coming up today from Engine Alliance with the words, "We make the reliable A380 engine." So,
That's a nice one. Yeah, there's been a few people making the obligatory, what British engine doesn't leak oil comments lately, because the A380 engines have had ongoing engine oil issues, not just the one that caused the explosion, but ongoing problems. There's been a couple of in-flight shutdowns or thrust-to-idle scenarios on the A380s that Qantas. But yes, Rolls-Royce, British engines, British engineering and leaks. Oops.
No, I've owned a few British cars in my life that leaked a lot of oil. But then again, my Australian-made Ford Falcon leaks a lot of oil as well. They better not put those engines on there either. Okay, just a couple of quick ones here as we move across the Tasman to New Zealand. It looks like Air New Zealand has had to ground its fleet of ATR-72s, something to do with cracking.
Yes, hairline cracks found around the cockpit windows, apparently. And as a precaution, they found it on one aircraft. They've grounded the lot until they're able to do a full review of all the aircraft.
Yeah, so more problems for Air New Zealand. They won't be too happy about that when they've just announced lots of job cuts and that sort of stuff recently. The last thing they need is more bad news, but hopefully that won't be a big issue and they can fix it. Speaking also of New Zealand, but not a New Zealand carrier, AirAsia X also looks like they're pulling out at least of one part of the New Zealand market. They're looking at pulling out of running to Christchurch.
That's right. They're dumping flights to Christchurch. They're claiming it was a bit of an experiment. Everyone else is like, what, really? They were supposed to be there for 2 years. They're pulling out early. They're currently pulling out of India. They have also already pulled out of Europe. Load factors were pretty high, so obviously yields were pretty hair thin, and with the price of fuel going up, they've decided to pull out of all these markets. Rumor has it, there's some reports on various websites indicating that people who are due refunds are not getting them, and that AirAsia is doing all it can to block and find other excuses for not paying back money for refunds. So that's got a few people in the industry starting to question whether AirAsia are about to do an Air Australia and go Tango Uniform.
Yeah, I was just waiting to use that Air Australia line. In fact, I noticed this week in the news that the former CEO there of Air Australia is still living the high life up there in Sydney or Brisbane, I think he's living.
Really?
Yeah, he seems to be doing okay. But I would have hated to have been waiting for a refund on a ticket, which will never come.
Indeed. Well, there's some people thinking that same scenario is likely to happen to AirAsia and AirAsia X, and people have been trying to get their refunds for months and are getting very vocal in their unhappiness, and some are even talking about the ACCC to investigate, who incidentally have already investigated AirAsia X because of their advertising.
Well, there you go. Well, I think we'll leave it there for this week. We don't want to create too much editing for Max. Well, I don't know, actually. I actually like this arrangement, Max.
I'm not sure I do.
Can we do this again, mate?
Yeah, let's do this every week.
It is fun to have you on live.
Yeah, well, we normally like to get this produced on a Saturday evening for our time, or Sunday morning, but just didn't work out this week. But on the bright side, the latest edition of Plain Crazy Down Under is out this week, so that's what we've been busy doing.
That's right, yeah.
That's everything for this Australia Desk. Grant, I'm going to have lunch.
Yeah, I think a beer is in order. I've been up since 3:30 crewing hot air balloons, so beer me.
All right, see you guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.
See you, everyone.
And now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
We've decided to look at other regional sectors on the segment, and today we're joined by Rohit Rao from the Aeroblogger website. Rohit is calling us today from Hyderabad in India, and he's joining us to talk about the airlines in India. Rohit, welcome to Across the Pond.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Rohit, before we talk about aviation in India, can you just tell us a little bit about Aeroblogger?
Aeroblogger is an aviation blog, and it mostly covers the Indian sector simply because I'm based here and I know about it.
Right.
But we've got quite a few team members from other places around the world too, and they contribute news and analysis keeping. Right now, we've got a team member in Singapore and one in South Carolina and the US, and we've got quite a few Indian members who live in different areas of the world as well. So we tend to look at startups on other parts of the world because the mainstream airlines are less interesting, but we like to understand what the future of different areas of the world is going to be.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. I certainly have enjoyed looking through the site, and this morning got some updates of airlines of the week, which I thought were very intriguing, and enjoyed your comments about them. So, the Indian airline market continues to boom, but no one seems to be making any money. Why is that?
Well, you'll find a lot of analysts in the media, they say things like the Indian aviation market is structurally challenged, or airlines are facing very significant issues. And normally there's no explanation after that, and that's a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
But there are a couple common themes that you find. One thing is they like to pick on the fact that fuel costs are very high here in India. There's import restrictions, a variety of taxes imposed. Petrol is controlled by the government, actually. It's all government companies who supply.
Yeah.
And fuel makes up a pretty major cost for airlines compared to airlines in the other parts of the world. So that's an issue. They do have higher fuel costs.
And does the government affect any of the airlines that it, should we say, supports or has investment in?
No. Air India pays the same fuel rates as other airlines. However, you'll find that Air India gets a little bit more credit from the fuel suppliers than other airlines, but they're paying the same rate. More leeway.
Okay.
And there was also a recent decision that means that airlines will be allowed to bring in fuel from abroad and store it themselves.
Okay.
That'll bring fuel costs down and hopefully bring it in line with international competition.
Yeah, and there is an awful lot of competition in the market in India as well. Lots of new starters coming into the market. Is there enough room for them all?
Well, yeah, there's six airlines right now, the three major airlines and the three full-cost airlines, and then three low-cost airlines.
Right.
And there's a lot of room in the low-cost carriers. Like, India is a very price-sensitive market.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of demand. A billion people need to move around the country, you know. So there's definitely room for new carriers. In the full-service, high end of the market, it's very full, I guess you could say. There isn't a lot of room left. But in the low-cost carrier market, there's definitely more room for more carriers, yeah.
100, 50, 20, 25, 25.
And one airline that's got itself into a little bit of trouble is Kingfisher, and they're exiting their Kingfisher Red brand from the low-cost sector. And they're also trying to get some rule changes for foreign investment. They're in a lot of trouble. Can they turn this business around?
I'm going to have to say no. I've predicted it pretty boldly that they won't exist in June on my blog. I don't think they have any chance left. They've entered a death spiral. And it's really interesting to look at why. Quite honestly, Kingfisher's problems are their own making.
Yeah.
They haven't made any money since 2005, 2006. Even Air India was making quite a bit of money. And it's mostly because of the mismanagement that they've been dealing with. They've got Vijay Malaya. He's a big liquor baron here, inspired by Richard Branson to create a fancy-smancy airline, you know. And there's a couple problems with that. One, there just isn't that kind of premium demand. They did lead the market in India in terms of yields per available seat kilometer. They got some very good fares, but their costs are just too high and there isn't enough demand. So what they did a couple years ago is they decided to buy out a low-cost carrier, Air Deccan, and enter the low-cost market as well with their Kingfisher Red brand. And that was because the low-cost carrier market is very large here in India and they wanted to tap that market as well.
Yeah.
But what happened after that is instead of keeping it as two separate brands, one low-cost carrier and then one full-service carrier, they sort of ended up in the middle. With the full-service carrier being devalued, they cut costs and they made it much less premium than it was before. And the low-cost Kingfisher Red ended up with a cost structure very similar to the full-service carrier. So they couldn't compete on price with the low-cost carrier because its costs were too high. And the full-service carrier was looking more and more like a low-cost carrier than a full-service carrier in the end. So they lost that revenue premium. They couldn't charge as much because the product was being devalued. And for the low-cost carrier, they weren't able to fill their planes because the fares were just too high. And since then, they've been kicked out of the IATA clearinghouse and then brought back in, and they haven't paid their staff in a while. And just generally, the entire industry has been losing confidence in them. Even if they manage to get themselves a bailout from the government, because the government is significantly invested in this, about 23-24% of the airline is owned by the government. And if they manage to get a bailout, it's just going to be throwing good money after bad. They're just going to end up in the same spot a year or two from now if they manage to keep going. I think it's the end of the road for Kingfisher.
Okay. All right. That's a good analysis. Thanks. The all A320-equipped Indigo Airlines seems to be doing pretty well. They've added new routes to Singapore, Dubai, and Bangkok.
Yeah. Indigo has also been doing really well recently. They've been expanding quite quickly. And a couple months ago in January, the DGCA, that's the Indian regulator, put out a report which showed that they're concerned about how quickly they're expanding. They're expanding really fast because they're doing really well. And the way they're expanding, they're worried about some possible safety issues with regards to overexpansion and not being able to keep up. But other than that, they seem to be doing well. They've been running a very good operation, tight operation. They've got the best on-time record in India and all of that. And they've managed to get what the customers want. The customers want low fares, clean planes, and reliable service. And that's really what they're providing. Whether or not they're making money, though, is up in the air right now. They're still privately held, so there's no numbers out there. And they've been doing a lot of sale, leaseback transactions and such, which gives them a lot of money right now. But as for their operation making profit, it's still not clear yet.
Thank you very much for that analysis. There's so much more that we can talk about, so we'd love you to come back on the segment in a short while and talk to us again. Where can we find Aeroblogger and you online?
Well, you can find Aeroblogger at aeroblogger.com, and you can find us on Facebook by typing in Aeroblogger. The link's a bunch of letters and numbers, which I'll never remember. And you can also find us on Twitter at The Aeroblogger.
Excellent stuff, Rohit. Thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
You can find Peter Johnson at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. Aviation with just a dash of culture.
Thanks, Peter. As some of you may be aware, the airline sector in India is changing daily, and particularly the fortunes of Kingfisher. So on that basis, Peter is going to ask Rohit to come back on the show in a few weeks' time to give us an update on the situation. Okay, we think we're going to pass on Grill the Geeks this episode, unfortunately. We're running a bit long, and we're having some gigantic Skype problems in the background. In fact, we've lost David altogether, so we'll wait till next week for that. So instead, moving on to listener mail. Just a couple. First one came from Seekar. I've once again caught up to the latest show, and once again, thanks for producing a great show that keeps me informed and entertained every week. You or David have probably heard this already, so maybe a short discussion would be good. And Seekar sent in a link to a couple of links, one on Flight Global and another one regarding an F-22 lawsuit. So we really need David to kind of help us with this. But basically, the F-22 crash, the pilot who died in 2010, I think it was, his widow is filing a lawsuit against a number of companies claiming that the aircraft was deficient or poorly designed and that resulted in that crash. So maybe we'll look forward to covering that a little bit in the future episode. He also writes an A380 question he had, which was that the Qantas A380 engine blowout of last year. He says, reading through the 747 book, I understand the groundbreaking work that the Boeing team, including Sutter, did on the design of the engine mount and location for the 737 and 707. He says, I'd never realized the amount of design work that was done to develop the engine nacelle system. The basic point was that the nacelle was designed in such a way that even if an uncontained engine failure did happen, the crucial components in the wing and the fuselage would be protected from the shrapnel. From the original reports of the A380 engine failure incident, I remember that several hydraulic lines and electrical lines were severed, and a fuel tank was also slightly damaged. So he asks, how could this happen? Is Airbus not taking as much care in hydraulic, electrical, and fuel system layout as Boeing? If this were true, would Airbus planes be inherently less safe than Boeing planes? So I can answer some of that anyway. I think that, no, I don't think that there's a sort of a design deficiency on the part of any one of the airframers. It is true the nacelle system, the engine pylon are enormously complex. When you're just looking at an airplane, that this looks like some sheet metal that hangs an engine off the wing, but they are, you know, amazing systems in their own right. I recall some years ago a visit to Boeing's plant in Washington State and being able to see what's kind of inside the nacelles, what's inside the pylons, and they're massive structures with a lot of components. Maybe after the engine and the landing gear, one of the more complex areas of the airframe. But you want engine failures to be contained. You want to minimize the collateral damage should that, you know, not take place. We don't see it happen very often. We did with this particular A380. So I guess that, you know, there'll be lessons learned from that. But I wouldn't worry about the safety of aircraft as a result. You guys have any other thoughts on that? Did you want to throw in or?
No, I was trying to think of the last time there was another uncontained engine failure like that. I mean, I remember one a long, long time ago where it. I think it was on DC-9 or an MD-80 or something like that. But that was a long time ago.
Yeah. We got another this cracks me up. We got another email.
You're not really going to read that Gil thing, are you?
This guy writes, he gives his name, says, this order is an individual order. This is an email we got at airplanegeeks.com. And I would like to make a purchase of a traffic controller. And I'll be more happy if you can email me with the types and prices that you have for sale as well. Please let me know if you do accept credit card as form of payment, and that will be pick up at your location. Hope to read back from you soon. So just in case any other listeners are confused, no, we do not sell traffic controllers. Maybe we should. Rob, are we missing a business opportunity?
Well, you know, think about what we were talking about when Steve Fulton was on. I mean, if all those controllers become redundant, as they say in Europe, because the next gen system is so good, maybe we could start selling them. I mean, there may be more of them on the market.
Yes, yes.
Or are we going to get some hate mail for that?
We probably will. All right, I want to recognize Dave Abbey sent in a little email. He was asking our David if there was some logic that drove him to choose the house he did at the end of the runway, or close to it, in Philadelphia. But since David has dropped off for right now, we'll have to ask David next time.
Why are we reading all these emails that we don't have David
I know. I think I'll just cut that all out.
Why don't we just call it the David Show?
Yeah, we'll have a David Show. Oh, I know, all the Davids. And then finally, Ryan writes in, after hearing about airliners flying at air shows, I have never seen an aircraft in an airline livery fly, but have seen a 757 operated by the Royal New Zealand Air Force put on a spectacular display at the Avalon Air Show here in Australia. Stephen Grant can fill you in on the details. We should have asked them while they were here. And yes, I do remember the flight simulator in XL-97, and I think Word-97 had a pinball game. So thank you, Ryan, for that. All right, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Captain Steve Fulton. He's a technical fellow at GE Aviation. I want to thank our contributors, as always, Grant McCarron and Steve Fisher from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, and Peter Johnson at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. So let's tell folks where they can find us online. Dan Webb, let's start with you. Where do folks find more Dan Webb?
And the question is, who actually would want to find more Dan Webb? And the answer is...
potential employers.
That's a good one. You boosted my self-esteem. Anyway, you can find my blog, thingsinthesky.com. You could find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
And Rob Mark, where do folks find you?
Well, they find me at the new Witty Fellow blog. That's for aviation geeks. We just started that about an hour ago, thanks to Steve Fulton. Of course, we also have massive advertising already tied to it, so you'll probably be seeing it on CNN pretty soon.
And,
okay, I just made that up. You probably didn't know that, but I just made that up. No, they can find us at JetWine.com, at JetWine on Twitter, at JetWine on Facebook, and I don't know, JetWine in the gutter. Who knows? You know, hanging with Dan.
Yeah. All right. I'll sub in for David Vanderhoof. You can.
Oh, I wanted to.
Oh, you. Okay. Well, go ahead. Go ahead, Dan.
You can find David on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. I believe you can also find him on Google Plus at David Vanderhoof. And you can find his blog at whatjustflewby.com.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight, and also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 190. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And you can stream us to your mobile phone from stitcher.com. If you'd like to send us email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye now.
Good night.
Oh,
he's back!
David, where did you come from? Well, we're done now, so... But thanks, David.
I just have one last question for Steve. I mean, he's a technical fellow at GE. Do they have any room for any, you know, witty fellows or
it's an
cool
amazing
fellows
company.
Or?
You know,
in Dan's case, fellow looking for
old fellow.
Fellow.
Hey, we're encountering some gigantic Skype issues of various sorts. David has sort of fallen off the planet.
I'm still here.
He's back. Are you back, Grant?
I think I'm back. Yeah, my internet was fine. I just dropped down to Skype.
It sounds like you're currently garbling marbles that are on fire.
Yeah, I do that before every old dish.
And unfortunately, your segment is already irrelevant because as of 4 minutes ago, Air New Zealand just put out a fresh news release on the ATRs.
Is Dan still with us?
Yes.
Okay. Nothing to add.
Rob's gone, though.
Okay.